Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Keelan McPherson.
And I'm Justin Romero. Today, on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by speaking with Corinne Carey about the New York Medical Aid and Dying Act, what it's about, and why it failed to pass. Then, we introduce a new weekly segment, The Plastic Bucket. This week, we hear about the fight in Louisiana against Formosa Plastics from a building, the largest plastic manufacturing plant. Later on, we listen in on a South End Community Collaborative discussion about the Times Union series on Albany's history of redlining. After that, we have a part three of our interview with Utica resident and Burmese revolutionary activist Zaw Nam Nguyen. And we end with an interview with Christoph Paul, the lead singer and songwriter and bassist of the local band Dionysus Effect. But first, here are the headlines.
New York's seven-day and single-day average COVID-19 positivity rates continued to fall to record lows. On Sunday, the state's 0.42% seven-day rate tied with Massachusetts for the lowest in the United States. 69.7% of all New York age 18 and older have received at least one vaccine dose, and 61.0% have completed their vaccine series. Eight COVID-19 deaths were confirmed across the state Sunday. 630 patients remained hospitalized.
The Gazette reports that many librarians in Schenectady are unhappy with their new five-year union contract. The librarians, who fall under the CSEA union, would go from a 37.5-hour work week to a 35-hour work week and lose 8 administrative leave days. The librarians are asking for the county to reject the contract and add about 2.5 hours and administer leave.
The Record reports that 7 stickball teams competed in Little Italy in Troy on Sunday in the Stick It to Childhood Homeless Stickball Tournament to benefit Joseph's House and Shelter. In 2020, 120 lived in homeless shelters provided by Joseph's House.
The city council has voted 4-3 to name itself as the lead agency for conducting their environmental review of the proposed rezoning and site plan of the controversial project that calls for building up to 240 apartments between 2nd Avenue and the Hudson River near the border of Shagatuck. The Friends of the Manicotuck, a community coalition protecting indigenous land and the last waterfront forests on the Hudson and Troy, have led the opposition to the rezoning.
State lawmakers last week approved a bill with a goal of cutting childhood poverty in half in a decade. The bill, if signed by the governor, would create an advisory panel to develop a set of policies and their effects on childhood poverty, including racial inequalities, along with budgetary and policy recommendations.
The Rensselaer County Board of Elections appears to continue to oppose the court order obtained by the state attorney general to open up an early voting site in downtown Troy. It has decided to allow voters to cast their vote at the Board of Elections office in the county office building at 1600 7th Avenue, Troy. This should be checked as to where the BOE stands on the lawsuit. That's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC, low power 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS, low power 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA, low power 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAL, low power 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Among the issues that failed to pass this year in New York State Senate legislation was the NY Medical Aid in Dying Act. We talked with Kern Carey, Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Care in New York, about why this bill is important and why it didn't pass, by Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Corinne Carey, who's the Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices in New York. And unfortunately, one of the bills that failed to pass at the end of the legislative session was the New York Medical Aid in Dying Act. Corinne, can you tell us quickly why that bill was important and why did it not pass this year?
Sure, Mark. Thank you so much. So as many of our listeners may know, New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act would have given terminally ill adults with less than 6 months or to live, would have given them the ability to say to their doctors, look, if you can't cure me and you can't relieve my suffering, please allow me to get a prescription for medication that I can take at a time of my choosing to bring about a peaceful death. And the reason that this bill is so important is that there are some people for whom even the best hospice and palliative care do not relieve their suffering. You know, there are certain types of cancers, certain types of neurodegenerative diseases where you're on pain medication for a very long time and it stops working, where your suffering for so many other reasons is so great that you want to be able to have some autonomy over what your last few days look like. Gather your family, say goodbye, and drift peacefully off to sleep and have a peaceful death. That's why this bill is so important. And every single year that the legislature fails to pick up this bill and pass it, more people suffer.
Now, I understand that this year or recently, you know, New Jersey has done it, a number of other states have done it. You know, why is New York, you know, so resistant?
So we have more bill sponsors than we've ever had before. We have 67 members of the legislature that have put their name on this bill. We have many more that have pledged to vote yes, but we're not there yet. And part of the problem is that there are some lawmakers who are refusing to meet with their constituents to talk about death and dying. I understand that death and dying is a very uncomfortable conversation to have, but good Lord, we've been through a year and a half of watching death and dying play out on television, in our own families, in our own communities. And what's harder than talking about death and dying is watching your loved ones suffer and knowing that there's nothing that they can do to change that. So the real problem here is lawmakers who fail to meet with their constituents and talk about this. Because I'll tell you, when we are able to have those conversations and, you know, show them that this bill may not do what opponents say it does, when we're able to you know, correct the record and show what kind of an impact this has on the real lives of real New Yorkers, lawmakers change their minds. And that's why we have as many bill sponsors as we have today.
Now, as someone who is raised in the Catholic Church, I would suspect that the Catholics may have been one of the groups lobbying against giving people the right to choose when and how to die.
Yeah, I mean, I too was raised in the Catholic faith. My family is very religious. And here's the long and short of it, Mark. Nothing will change for people who don't agree with medical aid in dying when this bill passes. Nothing. Catholic people, people who have certain kinds of faith beliefs are able to die in a way that's consistent with their faith and their values and their beliefs right now. And they will always be able to do that once this bill passes. Objections to this bill based on religion prevent other people from being able to die in a way that's consistent with their faith and their values and beliefs. No one wants someone with a different set of morals and a different set of beliefs making decisions about their lives, about the lives of their mothers, their loved ones. And especially, we wouldn't want someone who has a different set of religious beliefs making decisions about the way that our loved ones die, the way that my mother dies. I wouldn't want someone who's not Catholic telling my mother how she spends the last days of her life. Why would anyone? And that's all this bill does, is it allows all of us to make those decisions that are in line with our faith.
Where has Governor Cuomo been on this issue? Has he an opponent? Has he been quiet?
Yeah, he was asked on WAMC about 3 years ago where he stood on the bill, and he said that he supports it. He understands, you know, based on his own experiences with his father, he understands what dignity means at the end of life. And he supports medical aid in dying for terminally ill people. And he said, pass the bill, bring it to his desk, and he'll sign it. And so that's what the legislature has to do now.
Now, I can be guaranteed that your group is going to continue, you know, the struggle. But, you know, what needs to change to, you know, to get lawmakers willing to actually meet with their constituents? And, you know, how can, you know, individuals who, you know, want that right to choose the manner of their death, you know, how can they, you know, have their voices heard?
Well, listen, I'll give you an example. Dr. Robert Milch was the co-founder of Hospice Buffalo back in the 70s. He is an internationally acclaimed palliative care expert. He joined our campaign 4 years ago. About a month ago, he told us that he was diagnosed with cancer. And so, as he said, time was not the ally in his case. He knew that the legislature wouldn't pass the bill. But you know what he did in the last few weeks of his life? He called Senator Raff. He called Assemblymember Karen McMahon. He called Senator Sean Ryan and asked to meet with them. And they said no. They refused to meet with a dying constituent. And now Dr. Milch is dead. He died a week ago today. And he recorded a last video with us. It's up on the web now. It appeared in the Empire Report this morning. That is shameful. That needs to stop. These lawmakers can exercise their own judgment, but for goodness sake, listen to your dying constituents. You know, the next constituent that dies might be yours. So, Senator Breslin, where are you on this bill? Are you meeting with people in your community? Why is your name not on the bill yet? A vast majority of New Yorkers support this bill. We need to see these names on the bill. And here in the Capital Region, we need Senator Breslin's support. But for goodness sake, you know, to have lawmakers refuse to meet with a dying constituent, who are they representing? Whose values are they representing?
So I have sort of a two-part question. You mentioned that people, you know, want to see this video, go to your website. Let's get the web, address out there for people. And I assume on there is information about, this particular show. And the other question would be, in states that have implemented it, how does it work?
Oh, well, I was honored to lead the campaign in New Jersey. And so I am now working as the state director there, leading implementation efforts. I'm working with doctors, families, the Department of Health, and lawmakers to improve access, right? The sky hasn't fallen, Mark. You know, the same arguments were made, the same objections were raised in New Jersey, and we've now seen a year and a half of implementation. 33 people in New Jersey in the past year used this law to avoid needless suffering at the end of life. 33 people. But do you know who the benefits redound to in New Jersey? Everyone. Because there's a conversation now that people are able to have without worrying about crossing the line. They can have a conversation about what they're afraid of around death and dying, and they're getting referred to hospice in numbers like we've never seen before. Doctors are going and getting trained in how to deliver better end-of-life care. The benefits really do redound to a much larger community than people who ultimately decide to use the law. So there have been zero problems reported in New Jersey. None of the fears that opponents talked about have come to fruition. So, you know, and all of the lawmakers in New Jersey, the Senate president, the assembly leader, the governor, our bill sponsors were all Catholic. And they didn't lose their seats. They didn't have a backlash. In fact, our bill sponsor in New Jersey said that the bishop in his area was lobbying him up until the very last minute on this bill. And after the bill passed, the bishop said, "You did your job. Now I'm going to go off and do my job and counsel my congregants that this is not the right choice for them." That is the right way to legislate as a Catholic lawmaker. You know, do your job representing the variety of your constituents, and then leave it to faith leaders to tell their constituents how to make their decisions in concert with their faith.
Corinne Carey, Compassion and Choices in New York. Corinne, you got a web address?
Yes, it's www.compassionandchoices.org. So Compassion and Choices, all one word, .org/New York.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We just heard Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Care in New York. You can find more stories related to New York Medical Aid and Dying Act on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
In this first episode in a series on plastics, we talk with Sharon Lavinge of Rise St. James in St. James Parish, Louisiana. Rise St. James is fighting a massive plastic plant from being built in their neighborhood by Formosa, a Taiwanese plastic company. The plant would transform 2,500 acres of a former plantation, including the graves of people who were enslaved and imperiled wetlands, to produce items like plastic bags and artificial turf.
So this is Alexis Goldsmith with WOOC News from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And my guest today is Sharon Lavinge of Rise St. James in St. James Parish, Louisiana. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Thank you.
Can you please introduce yourself for our listeners?
My name is Sharon Lavinge, and I'm from St. James, Louisiana.
And can you tell us about your home in St. James Parish?
Well, my home, I live in the 5th District in a rural area of St. James Parish on the West Bank.
You are part of an organization called Rise St. James. So I think before we get into the Juneteenth event, our listeners need a little bit of context about Rise St. James and the issues that you're facing.
Rise St. James came about in 2018 when our governor, John Bell Edward, announced a $9.4 billion industry being built in St. James, 2 miles from my home. The industry is called Formosa Plastics.
Mm-hmm. So this has come to national attention recently because the Army Corps of Engineers revoked Formosa Plastics' federal wetland permit. So do you have any updates on where the project is at?
Not yet. We don't have any updates because they still have it where they're reevaluating it. So we haven't had any updates on it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the work that Rise St. James does.
Rise St. James is a community-based organization where we try to protect our parish, our citizens, and we want to make sure that we can breathe clean air, and drink clean water, and have productive soil, because all that is taken away from us. So we're trying to go back to what was done to us years ago and undo it so we can live better.
And you're planning a Juneteenth event in the coming days. What do you have planned?
We're planning a Juneteenth event, and we're also doing a continuation of our Black History program. We have 3 contestants that wrote stories about someone that they admire, and also about the chemical industries that's in this area of that's called Cancer Alley, which is now called Death Alley.
What does Juneteenth mean to you, Sharon?
It means that we are honoring our ancestors, that we are letting them know that they are not forgotten about. And we know that they born in slavery, or they were enslaved. And they worked, they died, and they were buried on the land that they worked on. So we want to let them know that they are not forgotten.
For our listeners that, you know, have maybe never heard of St. James Parish, but here in Troy, New York, we're fighting a hazardous waste incinerator that blows over our neighborhood. So can you tell us, you know, about your experience with organizing against industry and what your experience has been like working with the government on this issue?
Well, my experience are that they're not working with us. The governor approved this industry because he said it's going to bring revenue to the state. And our public officials in St. James, they went along with the governor and they voted this industry in. They voted it in without really understanding all of the issues involved in this industry and without understanding the emissions that will be emitted in the air and into our drinking water and also into our soil. They didn't really read it with a fine tooth comb. They just voted it in because they, Formosa presented to them a beautiful picture of what they're going to do, but they didn't tell our public officials about the health effects. Rise St. James did that.
Mm-hmm. And what are the health effects?
We wind up with cancer. That's the main thing we're winding up with is cancer and respiratory illnesses. And when we go outside, when the children go outside for a long period of time, they can't stay out there long because the air is so toxic. And they, some of them wind up with rashes on their bodies.
Mm-hmm. And Rise St. James is trying to get the attention of the Biden administration. What message would you send to Biden?
I would ask President Biden to come and visit St. James Parish and see what we are going through. Let him come firsthand and see for himself. We told him, but it's better if he come to see it. So we welcome him to come to St. James.
Well, ground hasn't broken on Formosa yet, correct?
That's right, it haven't.
Right, but you do have existing industries surrounding that area as well, correct?
Yes, we have 12.
12, wow. Including, I believe, Marathon and...
Marathon, New Star, Argonne, the Pipelines, Plains, American Styrenix, Mosea, Valero, a bunch of them.
And these are all petrochemical industries.
Some of them, yes, they are. Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but all of these industries have appeared in St. James in your lifetime. So this has happened very quickly.
The first one I noticed was in the late 60s. That's when the first one that I know that came in here. And we didn't know it was, we were breathing bad air, like PM 2.5. We didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But now we know.
Sharon, what is your vision for St. James Parish and the future for the people that live there?
We would like to have our community taken back. These industries are not doing us any good because they're making us sick and a lot of the residents are dying. So we would like to rebuild it up with another grocery store or some type of green jobs, something that we can live with and not breathe dirty air and not with all the chemicals in the air. And I would like to see a subdivision or something rebuilt in St. James, especially in the 5th District, because all of these things are taken away from us.
So more community based leadership?
Yes, we would like that too.
So for the Juneteenth event, how do you plan to celebrate the actual day?
Oh, with our Juneteenth event on the Formosa site. And we plan to sing, dance, and have speakers. Then after that, we're gonna top it off with a celebration at Rose's Catering with food and drinks.
That sounds wonderful.
Yes.
On the site, there are the graves of ancestors.
Yes.
Has there been any progress identifying who they may have been or how many people are buried there?
No, we haven't been successful yet, but we're working on it.
And has Formosa given you any greater access to the site?
No, they're not. They're always trying to fight us whenever we want to use the site. They give us all kind of restrictions and stuff. So we have to go by what they let us, by what they allow us to do.
Mm-hmm. But they say they're honoring
That's what they say, but that's not true. It's not true. They give us a hassle every time.
Mm-hmm. How would Rise St. James honor the site if you had control of that land?
I would honor the graves of our ancestors. I would put some type of marking or something to not for them to plow over it, not for them to put pipelines through the grave sites. And if I had the money, I would buy that property and build up a little subdivision around the grave sites.
Yes. It's a former sugarcane plantation, the site where Formosa wants to build.
Correct. Yes.
And because much of that area was plantation, it stands to reason that the industry that is currently there was also likely built on grave sites. Is that fair to say?
What you mean, the plantation that was there?
Because of the region that having many plantations, the industries that have already been built, Marathon and Valero, does it stand likely that there are graves on those sites as well?
I would think so.
Well, this has been Sharon Levine of Rise St. James in St. James, Louisiana. Thank you so much for your time, Sharon.
You're welcome.
You just heard Sharon Levine of Rise St. James, a group fighting Formosa Plastics from building the largest plastic manufacturing plant in the U.S. in their district in St. James Parish, Louisiana. You can find them at facebook.com/RiseSt. James. That's RISEST James. The Plastic Bucket is a new weekly segment. Tune back in next week to hear another story about plastics.
Those just tuning in, I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm Justin Romero. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
The Times Union has started a series of front page stories outlining Albany's history of redlining and other elements of systematic racism and the ways in which those elements have shaped today's urban problems. HMM correspondent Paul Smart recently edited comments from a South End Community Collaborative discussion of the series and suggestions for moving forward as an example of how communities are working to face a shared dark history.
This week, the Times Union started a series of stories, A City Divided, that charts Albany's history of redlining and other means of systemic racism, as well as some stories demonstrating glimmers of hope within the many communities that make up the city. It's been a point of discussion since launching on Sunday and centered much talk at the South End Community Collaborative meeting online on Tuesday, where those commenting ranged from former elected officials to agency reps, police officers, and SECC host Tom McFeeder, a lifelong journalist who noted the awards awareness that leads to such series, while also thanking the TU for drawing attention to the same issues that community groups have been wrestling with in the Capital Region for years, if not decades.
It was really helpful to see kind of the historical perspective of the article. It did make me really, really sad to see how far back and how in depth it is. So I think making sure that everybody's aware so that we can make positive change is the best that we can do, and start coming up with action steps to make sure that this doesn't continue.
The procedure of redlining is alive and well. When we bought land from the land bank in the South End and tried to get a mortgage, we couldn't. And even though we could show that we had enough collateral, they turned us down on insufficient collateral. So the banks are still dooming the area.
The other issue is, you know, that means, you know, the people who are living in these neighborhoods continue to be renters ultimately, or that segue from renter to homeowner is very hard. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think for most people on this call, it's kind of reinforcing what we already know. And again, kind of just driving the work that we're currently doing. I think just using the article and using fuel from the article, we have to come up with solutions, right? I think most of us know what the issue is. Most of us know the history of the issue. How do we solve this issue? And I think that's what this call and many calls, you know, especially in the South End, are about. How can we invest in our community? How can we have community ownership? So I think just kind of coming up with solutions and moving forward in that breath is going to be most important.
There's so many issues. I think as much as we want to try to do them and do them in the South End or Rockville West still on our own, I really think it's going to take a lot of investment from the state. From the feds to the state. The state's the one that built as apprentice and moved people in there. They built the Empire State Building. They're the ones that stuck that housing complex next to the port. They're the ones that are responsible. To me, it's like called the state's original sin, and they need to come forward and correct the mistakes they made. Local, we don't have the money. Somehow we got to get these grocery chains. You know, a lot of them have what they call urban style groceries now. They're not these huge 80,000 square foot stores anymore. They have one in Saratoga, they have some in Rochester. They're smaller, like 10 to 20,000 square feet. They put them right in downtown to the middle of the areas. And I looked into that years ago and I tried to get some of that done here. And they just won't budge in Albany. They just won't do it in Albany. And I think this is where, again, state legislators and maybe local elected officials can try to put pressure on these businesses that they have to invest in the banks. I know you mentioned the mortgage. I remember neighbors of mine telling me they couldn't get insurance on their homes. So the insurance companies wouldn't insure our homes in the South End because they're afraid of, you know, too many fires or because of vacant buildings. Even though supposedly it's, quote, against the law to discriminate because of vacant building on your block, but you couldn't get insurance either. So there's a lot here, and I think I really would like to have a sit down with all our state representatives for the local area and craft some legislation that can reverse some of these and get a commitment that, you know, they're going to bring in not $1 million or $100,000 and go cut a ribbon someplace. We need $100 million or more to rebuild some of this housing and to get a mortgage program where people can buy the rehab buildings and get a mortgage to a separate entity that the banks will give them to them after the buildings are rehabbed and take care of these vacant buildings. I mean, they have to step forward. I proposed many years ago, I called it the Rebuild Albany Authority. They got nowhere. I got laughed out of the assembly saying that it wouldn't fly because it was a... It wasn't sexy enough like the convention center was at the time. That was sexy. One building that does nothing to help us. So I really think we need to have a sit down with them and keep putting pressure on them. And the heck with ribbon cuttings on in front of a bicycle stand. Let's get a ribbon cutting in front of rehab buildings that are being sold to people in the community.
I just wanted to point out when we're talking about home ownership and solutions that we cannot take our eye off the fact that the city and the county are set to get $140 million combined in that COVID relief money. The city of Albany already has really good infrastructure as far as their CDBG program to get down payment assistance and rehabilitation assistance. So I think just sort of expanding that infrastructure, tweaking some of the policies that do keep Black and Brown people from accessing that funding and those programs would go a long way. But also, how do we use this once in a generation money to create that generational wealth? You know, can we take care of this city's blight while creating jobs for contractors, local businesses, training programs for Black and Brown youth to rehab these vacant apartments? It could all be a cycle of creating generational wealth. It's just, do we have the will to use this once in a generation, once in a lifetime money you know, to promote that.
I just want to make note that a place that we might start, that Habitat has had a little bit of success with doing, but definitely need more momentum, is using some of the Sunny Mae mortgage products. So that's the state mortgage agency. So they have a bunch of different mortgages, and one of them is specifically for Habitat affiliates. And it's just a really good outline of what a better lending product could look like. And so we use that almost exclusively with Habitat home buyers. But we've also in the past been able to like use that as a model to present to other banks to come up with something similar to it. So it's just, it's a nice starting place, I think, for us in terms of thinking, you know, how do we get around mortgages that, you know, rely solely or strictly or too heavily on a credit score? Like, are there alternative forms of credit that credits that bank banks can use? And the answer is yes, there are. And so I'd be happy to be a part of that conversation and to share the information I have from Sunny Mae.
Harris Oberlander, I think you had your hand up.
And yeah. I'll say this. You know, the families that we're talking about, the residents that we're talking about, are contending with social policy redlining that parallels housing redlining and lending redlining. And I think we have to remember that even though housing is in vogue all over the place now, especially with the healthcare managed care organizations in terms of being at the top of social determinant of health, poor outcomes, public health, child welfare, criminal justice are all siloed and stilted in a way that, you know, redline these families anyway. There's as a person trying to keep families together and preserve families, what we often contend with is the fact that funding sources are siloed. They don't talk with one another. They don't treat the whole family holistically. They're geared toward punishment and the back end of when families are already struggling. There's relatively little social policy that talks about supporting families where they live in neighborhoods that are urbanized with all the whole spectrum of services that that a family requires that help to support daily living. So as long as we're at it, I would ask that if we're writing letters and expressing concerns about policy and strategy, that we also take into account all the myriad of factors that are driven, in my opinion, first and foremost by racism, that are leading families to struggle in general, not just with their housing needs.
This has been Paul Smart for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Paul Smart sharing his excerpts from a South End Community Collaborative discussion about the Times Union series called A City Divided, which outlines Albany's history of redlining and related issues.
Utica resident and Burmese revolutionary activist Zanyang Wing sat down with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brennan Maslakas Dunn to speak about the refugee communities in Utica, the current military coup and political crisis in his home country, and the ongoing spring revolution that erupted. This is the final part of a three-part series of interviews with him. The full interview will be posted online.
We all know what is happening all over Burma, what is military, how military are treating people, how military are killing people, how military are lying people, how military groups are oppressing, arresting, and torturing a lot. Then the people are united each other. The people really see that how what is military look like. You know, they are just like evil, and they trying to maintain their power in order to control Burma. Then they are doing whatever they wants to do. They want to do. Then the people realize all military cheating, lying, and oppressing people. Then all united each other. Right now, even the Burmese people formed National Unity Government, and we have one gentleman who is residing in England. His name is Dr. Zani, who is very popular about Rohingya. He is like representing the Rohingya ethnic. So the NUG have created the foreign organization to like international relationship organization, and led by Dr. Sasa. Dr. Sasa requests Dr. Zani to join his foreign administration office. Then, so now we can see in a new government, we have like many represented for each individual ethnic group for Burma. Like we've elected Karen leaders. He is the prime minister for Burma right now, and we have many Karen leaders working for National Unity Government. That is why we have like a huge unity in Burma right now to win the military system fell down in Burma.
I think the last question I want to ask is, there's so many people right now that are trying to figure out what they can do at the grassroots level, you know, if it's Utica, Albany, Troy, anywhere in the U.S. or around the world, what can regular people do to help out with the revolution? And then also, what do you think has to be done internationally from different actors or governments or bodies to apply pressure on the current government in order for the revolution to succeed?
Let's see. Yeah, we are on the street every weekly here in Utica because we want to show the people, and we are hoping the people are coming and interest what we've been doing. So we need more people and more voices. We need like general community asking each individual representative for Congress, Senate, and force or asking the government organization, the government administration office to support Burma officially. And the each individual leaders for countries legally recognize our new government. Then we and National Unity Government, when National Unity Government became the officially recognized by all individual countries, then we will win. And also we want the United States government to transfer 1.2 billion, which is freezed by our President Joe Biden. That money, that money was for military, the previous military group having business with U.S. government. So U.S. since the military coup Burma, the U.S. government freeze that money. So I'm asking our president or government office to transfer that money to our new government, because our new government need like financially support, because in Burma right now our government, new government formed like PDF, we call People Defense Forces, because we need to defend our people. Then People Defense Forces, and then we are gonna our new government are gonna do like federal allies for Burma, in Burma. Then we are gonna form federal army, because we need federal system for future Burma. Then it's all represent for each individual minority ethnic groups in Burma. So we've named like federal army in order to fight the military back. With the international communities, we want United Nations to impose R2P system to Burma in order to support, because military organized by these military generals for over 70 years, they have sound institution. So they have like airstrikes, They just bought a submarine from India. They have strong army in East Asia, in Southeast Asia, the Burmese military. That is why we need international support, especially the Nations Security Council. Like, we are asking military action from all international communities. We kept asking our government, not only the people who live in United States, the people from Burma are asking U.S. because we want to be adopted by United States of America. This is how people believe. We want to change the country, not only the system, like education system, democratic system, and like infrastructure such and such, because we are very late in Southeast Asia. If no one help from international community, we are going to become like a North Korea. That is why people in Burma are asking right now, South Burma and North Burma, because who accept military system are allowing to stay in northern part of Burma? Who wants democratic system in Burma are coming to stay in South Burma? It is like that's what people wants, a people wishes came from their own heart. That is why we don't want to be happen. We don't want to separate our own country. We want to be united all together. We cannot separate. We just need to take down this military system in Burma.
Do you have any final words?
Yeah, my final words for U.S. government. We need legally recognized by our government. And I also requested the government to transfer 1.2 billion freeze by our government. And also, our government, new National Unity Government, has collected donation. It's over 9 million, but that money also freeze. Those are donation, and I want United Government to support that money to release, and we can help the people from Burma and all the other ethnic minority groups in Burma.
This is the final part of a three-part series of an interview with Za Nang Nguyen by Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brendan Maslaukis Dunn. The full interview is available on our website at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
For our last segment today, we have an in-person interview with Christoph Paul, the lead singer, songwriter, and bassist for the Direness Effect, a local rock band from Troy, New York. HMM's Gabe Cruz Allen asked Christoph about his motivation to start the band, goals for the future, and the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on local musicians in the capital region.
This is Gabe Cruz Allen for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm sitting here with Christoph Paul, a local musician from Troy, New York. So my first question is, how long have you been a musician, Christoph?
For a while. You know, I think I've been playing since high school, you know, so, you know, figure good 15 years, you know, when all said and done. First band was in high school and started with guitar and singing, and now I went over to bass because I have such a good guitar player. It seemed like a shame to play guitar, so I've worked on bass the last 5 years, and that's what I do now, bass and sing.
Okay, so primarily the bass.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet. So I know you have a band, and I know their name is the Dionysus Effect.
Yeah.
What led you to start the band?
So this has kind of been a process, this whole band. It's been kind of an evolution. Originally, I was in a band in New York City called The Only Prescription, and I was kind of getting burnt out near the end because I had a day job and doing other stuff, and I'm a writer, and you know, I was editing, but I met this amazing guitar player, and he was like a kid. He was like 18 years old at the time, and we became great friends after playing together, and you know, I gave a break from music after The Only Prescription. And then I started like, hey, you know, I'm switching over to bass. Why don't you play, you know, guitar and let's see what we can do. And him and I started working on these songs, which will be on our first album. And then we met Brett. I believe you've had him on another interview. He's also a musician. He plays guitar and sings in the band. Name.
It's called Raziel's Tree, Raziel's Trio.
And that for like all that together, really the band became real. And Brett, I met during, you know, I know him as a writer, but I was like, hey man, I need a drummer. And we have this pandemic and I'm going out of my mind. So we started playing together and then Sean joined and we're a band now. We're the Dionysus Effect.
Yeah. What would you say is the genre of your music?
I mean, we're a rock band at heart, you know, and I think rock needs kind of a comeback again. And I think like that word doesn't have the power it used to. And I want that word to have power. You know, I want that word rock. There's something about rock and roll. You could call it alt rock too, or indie rock, but it's rock. You know, it's really about rock and roll. And, you know, that Dionysus energy, which kind of influenced our name. So yeah, we're a rock band.
So where exactly does like Dionysus come from?
I mean, you know, he's kind of the Greek god of wine, and you know, he just that energy of fun and excitement, that Dionysus energy, you know, the party energy. I think, you know, if there's something, I want rock to be fun and a little dangerous again. I think that's missing. I think that's really missing. I think you have that in the underground, and like all the underground rock is really doing good stuff, but we're like become, I don't want us to become like jazz, you know, I want us back in kind of the mainstream a little bit. You know, people, there's not a better music to have fun to than rock, you know?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So what kind of genres have influenced you?
I mean, I'm really influenced by R&B more, if as much as rock, if not more. I love like Motown. I love kind of that 60s sound coming from that era. You know, I like 70s rock too and grunge. I like, you know, it's like 90s grunge and 60s R&B kind of really, really had a big influence on me. And I think in a weird way, I've been trying to meld those two genres together.
Okay, cool. And what kind of music do you like to listen to?
I mean, the cliche of I do listen to everything, but, you know, at my, like right now I'm listening to the latest Mark Lanegan album. He's a guy who was involved with Queens of the Stone Age, goes back to like Screaming Trees. So, you know, I listen to what I play. I like good rock music, or rock music that has like a dance vibe. You know, I like rock music you can dance to. I like playing that and I like listening to that.
Okay. And how would you say that COVID-19 and the pandemic have affected your ability and your plans to perform live?
I mean, we just played our first show. It was at like a farm, you know, it wasn't at like a typical venue. I think because of that, we've been so focused on like songwriting and getting ready to record our next album. It's, you know, playing like, I'm like, oh yeah, we can actually play live again. So I got to get back into that mindset.
Right.
I've been in like a total songwriter mindset. You know, I've not really, like, you never knew when this was going to happen again. So I was like,
right,
man, I just, now I got to get back in that performer mindset.
Uh-huh. And how do you see yourself as a local artist?
I mean, I've been in Troy now for a year and a half, maybe. Yeah, probably a year and a half. And I moved right before the pandemic. So I've not really got to immerse myself in the local scene, and it sucks. Like, I'm really hoping things open up soon. I want to meet other bands, you know, I'm into writing too. I want to meet other writers, and it's been very hard to do that, but I'm definitely here to stay, and I definitely want to represent the Capital Region as a musician and, you know, play here, play in New York City, you know, and who knows, maybe get a little rock scene started here again.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know there used to be a bit of a rock scene in downtown Albany around Polly's Hotel.
I like to play Polly's.
And the Low Beat.
Yeah, I got to see like one show at the Low Beat.
Yeah.
Or, you know, RIP, you know.
Yeah, I know for myself, I went to shows at both of those places, but yeah, it was both before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, I'm not even sure if those places are going to open up again.
I think Polly's will.
Oh. Did you hear somewhere that
they're going to open? Yeah, I heard that Polly's is opening up, but Low Beat's gone.
Oh, okay. So, Christoph, how do you want to be seen and received by the public?
I mean, I just want to be seen as a rock band with catchy songs. That's a quality rock band with catchy songs. I'll be happy with that. That's really fun to see and listen to. You know, I want to be a fun rock band. I'll be happy with that. You know, I just... That's enough for me, you know. I just want to be part of that next wave of rock, and I'd like the Dionysus Effect to be part of that. I'm excited for our first album to be coming out. It's planned to drop in like late September of this year. We've actually written pretty much the second album. We'll probably record it near the end of this year, but we're not going anywhere. I'm excited. I'm hoping that that venues open up like Polly's and we can start playing these songs to people.
So, but would you say that you guys are like pretty focused on songwriting right now?
I would say that's coming to an end and we're going to focus more on like performing and playing live shows.
So do you guys have any ideas of where else you would play?
That's going to be the next step. Just kind of finding venues that open up. It could be New York City. I think it'll be in the fall. I think we're going to probably not really have shows till September or October. And
okay.
we'll be definitely ready to play those.
Okay. Awesome. So, Christoph, where does the Dionysus Effect record music?
We record in Peekskill at our guitarist Sean's workshop. It's literally called The Workshop. He has a studio down in Peekskill. And we recorded that recent song, the In Defense of Ska, which we put up on YouTube. Even though we're not a ska band, we did a ska song for the book In Defense of Ska. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, it felt really good. So we've kind of been just like focused on studio stuff since the pandemic. But we're ready to get back to performing live.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for interviewing with me.
That was Gabe Cruz Allen interviewing Christopher Paul, the lead singer, songwriter, and bassist of the Dionysus Effect. Well, that wraps up another show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Justin Romero. Our engineer tonight was the lovely Sina Basilihicky. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community and for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
This program is produced by entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories. Through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe and get into nature.